see it, Julia. It's octagonal in shape, and there's a, I don't know, a balcony or mezzanine or something that runs around the interior, and Charlemagne used to sit up there above the west door and look down on the priests who were celebrating Mass, and he'd conduct the service, Julia. Using hand gestures, he'd point to one priest after another to read the scriptures, offer a prayer, preach, or whatever, and cut them off if they went on too long. Can't you just see it? It was marvelous, honey. I can't wait to show you the pictures.
I can almost see it the way you describe it. But what kind of name is Charlemagne? I've always wondered about it.
Well, I guess it's the French form of his name, he said. In Latin, it was Carolus Magnus Charles the Great having been earned during his lifetime. But Magna, in Latin, can mean big, tall, noble, great, and so on. And apparently Charles was tall, and he was certainly an exceptional warrior, leading dozens of campaigns while putting together his empire. But the Franks seemed to like adding a descriptive word to names. Some of Charlemagne's descendants were Charles the Fat, Louis the Blind, and Charles the Bald.
Oh, the poor things. But listen, I can add a few descriptions to your name. Sam the Handsome, Sam the Kind, and especially Sam the Sorely Missed. Hurry home, sweetheart. When the mail came, I took the stack of ads, bills, and flyers into the library to go through and discard 3/4. Have you noticed how pleas for Christmas donations seem to come earlier and earlier each year? And not just pleas, but strong suggestions of how much they think you should give them. I declare they'd begun showing up in my mail before I'd even bought trick-or-treat candy. Now here it was barely past the 1st of November, and you'd think there was a race to be the first heartstring-plucking solicitation you received. What they didn't know was that I considered none of them until the last of the Thanksgiving turkey had been turned into hash. But in the midst of the current stack, I came across a small, square, pink envelope with my name and address written in cursive script. No return address, though. An invitation to something, I thought, and also thinking that it was a little early for Christmas parties. But some people liked to claim a date before the highly social people of Abbots fulfilled their calendars. So maybe I should start thinking of having something for Christmas, I thought, as I held the envelope and considered the possibilities. Maybe a dinner party or a reception of some kind, or, well, who knew? I wasn't presently in the mood to plan anything festive. I opened the envelope and withdrew one of those fill-in-the-blanks invitations. This one had pictures of little kittens sipping from teacups. Who in the world would send such a cutesy thing? I soon found out. You are invited to a housewarming tea on Sunday, November 26th, 2 to 4 p.m. at 329 Jackson Street, Abbotsville, North Carolina. Come help us celebrate the opening of the first Home for Teens, H4T, RSVP, Mrs. T. Calvin Taylor, 987-555-2239. I jumped to my feet, spilling the pile of unwanted mail onto the floor, and stomped into the kitchen. Lillian, I said, waving the tacky pink missive in the air. This is the most flagrant violation of good manners I've ever seen. Madge Taylor knows I don't want to celebrate the opening of that house, and she knows I don't want her celebrating it either. She's just rubbing my face in her law-breaking victory over the neighbors and the zoning board. Ah, T, have you ever heard of such a thing? It's a deliberate affront to decent people who just want the laws obeyed and their neighborhoods protected.
Ma'am, Lillian said, frowning at my agitation. What you ranting and raving about?
This, I said, thrusting the card at her. This invitation. I patted my chest, trying to calm myself in the face of Madge's outrageous assumption that I would want to celebrate the opening of what I so desperately wanted to shut down. It took me 15 minutes to get it all off my bursting chest to Lillian. She knew a little of it. How could she not, with my outrage bubbling over every day?
Well, she said, why don't you just not go?
I most certainly won't, but there has to be something more I can do to register my extreme disapproval.
I finally sat down at the table, nearly overcome by my powerlessness.
And look, Lillian, just look at it. I waved the card in front of her. Have you ever seen anything like this? Homes for teens or H4T. How cute. How clever. How silly.
Lillian set up a cup of coffee on the table.
You better calm yourself down. You'll be having a stroke before Mr. Sam get back with all that carrying on.
She stood for a minute looking down at me. Then she said,
I expect Miss Hazel Marie won't go neither.
You're right. She won't. And, I went on, sitting up straight, neither will the Pickrells or Mrs. Osborne or Mildred or Helen or anybody else within blocks of that house. It'll be a public shunning, that's what it'll be, and I hope they get the message.
Lillian twisted her mouth as she thought about it.
There might be some folks that'll want to see what's been done to that house. They might show up just to see what they're going to have to put up with.
That is true, I said, sadly conceding the possibility. We've tried to keep everybody in opposition to it on the same page, but you're right. There'll probably be some who will go out of curiosity. And there'll certainly be a contingent of pastors and church members who've had the wool pulled over their eyes.
They'll want to see where the money wheedled out of them went.
Well, I said, rubbing my hand over my face, we'll just have to contact the neighbors and tell them not to let those Homes for Teens people have the satisfaction of crowing over us, because we're not through yet. I'm letting Binky know, and I'm calling the city attorney and the zoning board and whoever else I can think of and telling them that those people are about to open for business and it's time to evict them from Jackson Street. And, I said, springing to my feet so fast that Lillian had to jump back, I know what else I can do. Polish the silver, Lillian. I'm going to have a Christmas tea to meet all other teas on November the 26th from 2 to 4 o'clock, and I'm going to invite everybody who's had anything to do with that house, whether for or against, and I'm going to take note of anyone who doesn't come or who tries to attend both. I'm not going to sit home holed up while those people celebrate getting their way. I am not taking this insolence lying down. Lines shall be drawn and names taken.
Chapter 22.
Mildred, I said when Ida Lee called her to the phone, I'm coming over.
Then pulling myself together and recalling my manners, I asked, are you busy? I really need to talk to you.
Well, come on. I'm so bored that I'm thinking of redoing the whole house. I'm tired of having everything Louis the something or other. What do you think of mid-century modern?
Not much, and certainly not for your house.
But get ready. I'm going to cure your boredom by giving you something to really think about. See you in a few minutes.
I got one, too, Mildred said, glancing at the invitation I'd brought with me.
She waved the wrinkled, kitten-embellished invitation away with a dismissive gesture of her hand. We were sitting in her chintz-filled sunroom, she in a large, cushioned wicker chair, and I on the edge of another one.
Already threw it away, too, she said, without RSVPing. A big no-no, I know, but their arrogance doesn't deserve a response.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. But listen, Mildred, I'm thinking of having a tea on the same day at the same time and inviting everybody I can think of. They'll all think I'm doing it out of spite, and they'll be right. But I don't care.
The problem is, I went on, how can I keep people from attending both? You know, dropping in for a little while at both parties.
Well, Mildred said, her eyes lighting up as ideas began to pop into her head. First of all, why don't you have it here? My house is bigger, and what with that huge foyer, my double living rooms and so on. We could invite twice as many if you would, and as far as making sure that everybody comes and stays for the full 2 hours, we could call it a soiree. But it has to be from 2 till 4 when they're having theirs. It won't accomplish anything if we do it at a different time, and soirees are evening affairs.
Who cares? Mildred said with another wave of her hand. If you and I call it a soiree, then that's what it'll be. I mean, who would question it? We're the social arbiters in this town, or haven't you noticed? And what we say goes. But soiree does imply something special.
So, the way to keep everybody here for the full 2 hours is to give them something special. Start thinking what it can be.
Well, the end of November is a little early for Christmas, but...
No, it isn't. Get that pad and pencil on the desk over there, if you will, and let's make some notes.
I did, and sat poised to write whatever she came up with, because when Mildred gets on a roll, she can really throw a party.
Here goes, she said, her eyes gleaming. First I'll have the house decorated for Christmas. A huge tree in the foyer and greenery everywhere. Write that down, Julia. I'll call a couple of florists to do all that. Also, oh, food. No problem with that. Between Ida Lee and Lillian and a couple of bakeries, we'll have a feast. Don't worry, Ida Lee will see to the menu. Now, she said, leaning forward as far as she could bend. We have to have something for our guests to look forward to. Something for them to come early and stay late for. What about putting on the invitation something like 2 o'clock sharp, doors close at 2:15? Or maybe no admittance after 2:15? What do you think?
I think, I said, laughing, that it's a good thing we're not inviting Emily Post or Amy Vanderbilt. Nothing like that has ever been done.
But that's the beauty part of it, Mildred said. It'll put the guests on notice that something special is going on, and they have to be here for it. Let's think what it could be.
Well, music, for one thing.
Yes. But not some tinkling piano or sleep-inducing harp, though. Let's have a trio or a combo or something that'll play a few Christmas carols for the spirit of the season, you know. But also some good dancing music. It should be fast, toe-tapping music that'll get people moving. The foyer will be cleared out except for a huge Christmas tree, and it's a wonderful place to dance.
The thing to do, Julia, Mildred went on as if in confidence, is to designate a few couples beforehand to start the dancing. Hazel Marie and that handsome man of hers, for one, and Binky and Coleman, and Sue and Dr. Hargrove, couples like that who encourage others to dance.
Oh, I said, excitement beginning to build. I can see it now. This is going to be fun, Mildred.
But wait, there'll be some who won't dance. They could get bored and want to leave early.
Well, hold on. I'm getting an idea.
What do you think of having a drawing?
I frowned.
A drawing? Like a picture?
No, like a drawing for prizes.
I frowned.
You mean a raffle?
No, not a raffle, for goodness sake. We won't be selling chances.
What we'll be doing is giving away prizes. And the guests have to be present to win.
See, we could have a drawing, say, every 30 minutes, and the prizes should be worth waiting for.
And, she said, her face lighting up, we'll save the best and last prize for 5 minutes to 4, but they have to be here to win. And anybody who's already won something will be eligible for that one, too.
Mildred sat back in her chair as if to rest after the exertion of party planning.
If that won't keep them here and away from that other party, I don't know what will.
I'm inclined to agree with you, I said, but somewhat doubtfully by this time. That other party, that abominable tea, will expect gifts, money from the guests, not the other way around.
But, Mildred, I don't know about all this. There's never been a party like it. I mean, what do you think it's, well... appropriate?
Mildred gave me a direct stare.
Listen to me. Why are you thinking of having a party in the first place? What are you hoping to accomplish? Well, I want the Homes for Teens people to have a party where nobody shows up, and by that, to show them they are not wanted where they are.
Well then, she said right back at me, what we're planning is perfectly appropriate to what both of us want to accomplish. Get over your concern about the properties, Julia. We're dealing with people who have no compunction about running roughshod over anybody in their way. And I intend to give them a taste of their own medicine. So if you're getting cold feet, I'll do it by myself.
Oh, no, I can't let you do that. It was my idea to have a competing party in the first place.
I just need to think it through for your sake as well as mine. I twisted my mouth in thought, then went on.
We'll have to be prepared to have half the town or more thinking that we're heathens who are trying to turn homeless boys out on the street. Think of letters to the editor and prayer meetings and such like.
Mildred's eyes rolled back in her head.
You, of all people.
Worried about what people will think?
Let me remind you, Julia Springer Murdoch, that you're the one who opened the door to your husband's mistress and illegitimate child, paraded them around town, marched them to one of the front pews in church, blackmailed people into inviting them to their homes, and dared anybody to say a word against them. You turned this town upside down and made the town like it.
Mildred leaned back after that diatribe and smiled at me.
I've admired you ever since. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I handed her the notepad with our list of plans, stood to get my coat, and with renewed backbone said,
I'd better go. It's getting dark. I'll be thinking about the kind of enticing prizes we can give away.
Chapter 23. Just how much money, effort, and social repute did Mildred and I want to expend on an alternative party? I considered that as I walked across her lawn and into my side yard, pulling my coat close as the late afternoon chilled. It didn't matter, I concluded, if it accomplished what we wanted. We'd be the talk of the town no matter what we did, so we might as well make it worth talking about. I pushed down a few tiny qualms that kept trying to get my attention about the wisdom of publicly airing our opposition to the invasion of a stable neighborhood. Yet to simply give up and give in to zoning lawbreakers went against my nature. I obeyed the laws. Why shouldn't everybody else? And hadn't those Homes for Teens people done their level best to advertise what they were doing? Asking for help, for money, for prayers? All done as if they had every right to be where they were and do what they were doing. And there was no doubt that the very people they were soliciting assumed everything was on the up and up. It was high time that assumption was put to rest, and generous people were told in no uncertain terms that their money, time and efforts were going to support an illegal undertaking. Lillian, I said, entering the kitchen and sliding out of my coat, Mildred and I are planning a party to end all parties. I went on to tell her that it would be at Mildred's house, relieving us, well, her, of a lot of house cleaning in preparation for a large number of guests. You and Ida Lee will be in charge of the food, but we'll purchase as much as we can ready-made. We want it to be substantial and beautifully displayed, so be thinking of what we can have. And be thinking also of what we can offer as prizes.
What kind of prizes you talking about?
So then I told her of our plan to keep all the guests at Mildred's house until 4 o'clock came and went, thus preventing any of them from showing up at the Homes for Teens. Lillian looked at me from under a lowered brow.
You sure you know what you're doing?
As sure as I can be. We've tried fighting those people with attorney's letters, and they ignored them. We've gone to the zoning board and spoken with the city attorney, and they can do nothing until the house is operating. Mr. Pickens has built a wall on three sides of that house and set Ronnie on them. And still, Lillian, they go blithely on their way as if they have a mission from on high.
Maybe that's what they think.
Well, if that's the case, they need to be reminded to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, which means obey the laws.
And with that, I changed the subject slightly.
If you were to win a prize, Lillian, what would you want it to be?
I sure could use a little Christmas money, she said. Letitia wanting some kind of pad or notebook or something that costs an arm and a leg.
We'll think about that a little later on, but for now, think of something besides money. What would thrill you if your name was drawn to win a prize?
I don't know. Maybe a gift card to Walmart?
I rolled my eyes just a little, thinking of how that would go over with the tea-attending ladies of Abbotsville. On second thought, though, I decided not to discount it. In fact, I had a lot of second thoughts throughout the evening, and gradually came to the conclusion that Mildred's elaborate plans for a competing party would not work. For one thing, we had no idea of the length and makeup of the Homes for Teens invitation list. For all we knew, they would put an open invitation in the bulletins of every one of those 7 praying churches, and we couldn't compete with that. Nor, I thought, would we want to. Why, we could end up with several thousand churchgoers showing up at Mildred's door. So, of course, could the Homes for Teens, and there was no way that the Cochrane House could accommodate such a crowd. That being the case, I decided that invitations to their tacky tea would have been limited to their own board members, the preachers of the 7 churches they were courting, the most influential and well-heeled ladies in town, and, of course, the affected neighbors, to demonstrate their benign presence among them. I briefly considered that they might have invited the zoning board administrator, the city attorney, and the city commissioners, then quickly decided that they hadn't. They would have taken no chances that would appear to dare the powers that be to exercise their authority to shut them down. They intended, I surmised, to keep a low profile until they were fully entrenched in the neighborhood. So, I concluded, there was no need for Mildred and me to go all out with our guest list or to bribe guests with high-value prizes at an ill-named soiree. All we had to do was have an elegant tea and invite people who would have obviously also received invitations to the tacky one. Those guests would know what we were doing, and they would know better than to attend both. And to that end, I would have Lloyd and Ronnie sit on Hazel Marie's front porch and keep a list of anyone who rang the Cochrane House doorbell during the hours of 2 till 4 on Sunday, November 26th. Ronnie would make sure that Lloyd didn't miss anyone. And the word would go out that those individuals who rang the Cochrane doorbell would be off my and Mildred's guest lists for the foreseeable future. I would see to that. I was feeling much more comfortable with the idea of having a more circumspect party than the one that Mildred had envisioned, which, to tell the truth, had all the aspects of a carnival rather than of a ladies' tea. With that settled to my satisfaction, my next step would be to get Mildred to agree to tone down her exuberant plans and have, instead, a sedate, exclusive, and envy-inducing tea. Mildred, I said when she answered the phone, I think I'm having second thoughts.
Well, she said, I think I am too. We could have half the town show up, and just think of the parking. We could be biting off more than we could chew.
I'm in full agreement, I said, considerably relieved that she was so amenable. I think I'll go back to my original plan and have a tea, maybe even a high tea, even though it might be a little early in the day for that. I'll just invite our usual guests, plus the Cochrane House neighbors, and let it go at that.
And Julia, Mildred responded, that's exactly who Madge and her cohorts have invited, because they'd have the same problem we'd have if they invited half the town. I think you'll accomplish what you want by doing it that way.
Yes, and if any of my guests want to drop in here, then go to the Cochrane House, there's no way to stop them. But I'll know who they are, and I won't forget it.
Nor will I, Mildred said.
Then with a sudden intake of breath, she went on, Wait a minute. I'm having a wonderful idea.
No prizes, Mildred. I'm just not up for bribing guests to honor me with their presence.
Well, me either, but that's not what I'm thinking. Listen, and tell me what you think. You have your tea from 2 till 4, and I'll have a supper party from 4 till 6. Husbands can join us for that, and it won't be too early for supper since it gets dark by 4:30. What do you think of that? We'll have the best of the best totally occupied from 2 o'clock until 6, or until whenever they want to leave.
Why, Mildred, I love that idea. And just think, once they get parked for my party, very few, if any, will want to give up their parking space to go to the Cochrane house and come back. They'll stay where they are and walk to your house from here. It's perfect.
It is, indeed. Now listen. We'll have to coordinate our guest lists. You'll invite the wives, and I'll invite their husbands to join them. Of course, she said, stopping for a minute to think, there are some without husbands. Luann and Helen come to mind, but I'll reword their invitations. We certainly want all the usual suspects, don't we? I laughed.
We certainly do, plus the immediate neighbors who were affected by that house.
One thing, though, Julia, Mildred said, you don't want to serve anything heavy. We want them to be hungry enough to come over here for supper.
Oh, absolutely. I'll offer only hors d'oeuvres and maybe oyster stew served in small cups. I paused, considering the menu for such a party. You know, Mildred, these are the times when I can see the benefit of alcoholic beverages. I mean, we're essentially kicking off the holidays, and a tiny toddy would be in keeping with the season.
Mildred laughed. I've been trying to tell you that for years. But don't worry. That'll be all the more reason for everybody to come on over to my house. They'll get it here, that's for sure.
Well, I went on, think of this. There's no way the Homes for Teens can offer spirits of any kind, not even wine, because that would offend the Baptists. And serving alcohol would undermine their stated purpose of rehabilitating teenage boys.
You're right, Mildred agreed. Why, I expect 14 to 18-year-old boys are already quite familiar with six-packs and grocery store wine. If their keepers serve it, that would just put their stamp of approval on it.
I think I'll talk to Sam and see what he says about my serving it. He'll be home in a few days, and I think he might agree that maybe something a little more festive wouldn't hurt.
That would be perfect. We don't want them so sloshed they can't get across the lawn to my house.
Much relieved that Mildred saw the wisdom of toning down our plans, I was also more enthusiastic about our new ones. No one I could recall had ever had a double party in adjoining houses. It would be the talk of the town, and invitations would be eagerly awaited and quickly accepted. And soothing to my troubled mind, I doubted that anyone would give a second thought to Madge Taylor's invitation to view a refurbished warehouse for miscreant teenagers. Which brought up another question. Should I invite Lynette Rucker, the pastor's wife? If I did, which under ordinary circumstances I certainly would, Mildred would have to invite the pastor as well. What would he think of my serving spirits? Did I care? All things considered, I didn't think I did. Chapter 24. Quickly coordinating our guest lists, Mildred and I discussed, then either discarded or agreed upon, one name after another. I ended up with 42 ladies' names, and Mildred, who included husbands on her list, more than doubled that, considering widows and divorcees and their male counterparts, in addition to a number of elected town officials and their wives, plus the immediate neighbors of the Cochrane house. Let's use informals for the invitations, I suggested, and have Louise Hempel write them. She has a beautiful hand, and she needs the money. She's fast, too. We can have them in the mail by the end of the week.
Oh, yes, Mildred agreed. I've used her before, and she does a lovely job. Just be sure you give her a correct original to go by. One time I misspelled cotillion on the original, and she sent out 200 invitations with the same spelling.
I had to laugh, for something like that would happen only to Mildred.
Working with Lillian, I decided on a menu suitable for a pre-supper party, neither too heavy nor too skimpy.
"We just can't not have ham biscuits, Lillian," I said, toiling over a list of party hors d'oeuvres. "I mean, it is an autumn affair where they'll be expected, but they might be too filling. We want the guests to be hungry enough to go on to Mildred's for a meal. She'll have my head if I fill them up before they get there, or if they decide not to even go."
"Why don't we have them little teensy biscuits?" Lillian said. "Like one bite size, or maybe two for some ladies, and when their tray's empty, just not put out any more."
"Well, that's a thought. We'll have lots of fruit and several cheeses. Maybe a dip with vegetable spears and maybe water crackers with cream cheese and a dab of caviar on top. And I'm thinking we should only have one sweet tray." Sighing, I put down my pen and looked up at Lillian. "I'm giving serious thought to serving alcohol in some form or fashion. It would take the place of a lot of food." "So," I went on, "Sam may divorce me, but let's have a spiked punch." "Oh, I know. I have Etta Mae Wiggins's champagne punch recipe. That's what we'll have, along with coffee and maybe hot spiced tea. An oyster stew, Lillian. We have to have that. And serve it in my demitasse cups. That way people won't fill up."
"Yes'm, but if you give them too much to drink, they might all have to go to the bathroom at the same time."
"Goodness! Surely they'll pace themselves."
"Oh, and another thing, Lillian," I said. "Do you know a couple of young girls who can take coats upstairs as the guests come in?"
"Yes'm. But I hope you know what you're doing with spiking that punch," Lillian said with a skeptical frown. "You having your preacher?"
"No, but I'm having his wife. Mildred's inviting him, but she's an Episcopalian, so he'll know what to expect there."
"He probably won't expect it here, though."
"Well," I said somewhat sharply, "he doesn't have to drink it. But if it offends him, then too bad. He's offended me often enough."
"Law, Miss Julia," Lillian said, laughing. "You are pissed when you get on your high horse. One good thing, though, can't nobody say you sit in your ways like a lot of people get."
"You mean like a lot of people get when they get old?"
"No, I didn't mean exactly like that, although it do be the truth." I laughed.
"Thank you, Lillian. I take it as a compliment to be able to change with the times. Although," I said a little pensively, "the times don't always suit me, and I reserve the right to denounce them whenever I want."
"Me too," she said. Then mumbling, she went on, "Whatever that means."
I continued to sit at the kitchen table, checking and double-checking my lists, not only of guests to be invited and food to be served, but also of Christmas decorations to be bought or brought out of storage while Lillian worked around me. I declare the Department of Defense was overlooking a valuable resource by not employing socially active women in their strategic planning offices. It took a far-seeing eye attuned to detail and an analytical mind to plan a mode of attack as well as a decent social affair. Just as I was about to finish, I heard a rap at the back door. Looking up, I saw Hazel Marie open the door and walk in.
"Am I interrupting anything?" she asked. "I can't stay but a minute. I'm on my way to the dry cleaners, but just had to stop to give you the latest news."
"Oh, do come in, Hazel Marie," I said, pleased to see her. "Come, have a seat. Lillian and I were just finishing plans for a party."
"Oh, good. I need a good party to take my mind off things."
"Lillian," she said as she sat beside me at the table, "how are you? I hope you're not missing Ronnie too much."
"No, I'll get used to him being gone pretty quick."
"Well," Hazel Marie said, taking a deep breath, "I hate to carry tales, but I overheard some ladies talking yesterday, and I just had to tell you. It wasn't like I was deliberately eavesdropping, but I was out by that fence of J.D.'s trying to figure how many bushes I'll need to plant, and, well, you know how warm it was yesterday.
Unseasonably so, I said, as Lillian nodded in agreement.
Yes, well, there's one tree in the Cochrane yard, and it's right next to the fence. She stopped as if wondering whether to continue, but she did. J.D. says he's going to rake up every leaf that falls in our yard and dump them all on their front porch. But, well, anyway, all of a sudden, three ladies, I wasn't sure who they were at first, but they'd been working inside that house, so they came out and sat under the tree to eat their lunch. You know, when they come to work over there, they all bring bagged lunches. So there they were, talking about how much they were enjoying fixing up that house. And there I was, right on the other side of the fence, afraid to move. I couldn't help but hear what they were saying.
What was it? I asked, leaning forward.
They were talking about what they were doing for what they called those poor, unloved, mistreated, and deprived children. And I'll tell you, it was the silliest stuff I've ever heard. I recognized Mary Nell Warner's breathy voice. You know how excited she can get. But Miss Julia, she's had no experience whatsoever with teenage boys. She's never even been married. But she told about an old train set she was going to bring and set up for the boys to play with. And one of them, I'm sure it was Lorna McKenzie because I'd seen her go in the house that morning. Anyway, she said she'd bought two bedspreads with cowboy designs on them that were just so cute, and somebody else, it sounded like Diane Jarrett, she said she'd had so much fun rearranging furniture, putting out cushions with clever sayings like hope, eat well, and you can do it, and she said she'd put flowers and vases around the rooms to perfume the air. They went on and on like that, trying to outdo each other and prepare in the house. And I declare, they sounded for all the world like little girls playing house. They almost had a falling out over the color of towels to go in a bathroom.
Oh, for goodness sake, I said, slumping with near despair. That house is nothing but a pastime for them with no thought of the responsibility of taking on wayward teenagers. I wonder how long their interest will last when there's a fight, or one stays out overnight, or the cops come callin'. And, I went on, Lorna and Mary Nell are busybodies of the first order, anyway, and if they were there, I'll bet Sadie Morgan was, too.
Oh, she was, Hazel Marie said, because one of them said she was crocheting a maroon throw to go on the sofa, and crocheting is Sadie Morgan's thing. She sent me a set of pink doilies when we moved into Mr. Sam's house. Well, Hazel Marie said, leaning her head on her hand, it's just one thing after another. Every time I turn around, there's something else to worry about. Why, just this morning I caught J.D. teaching Lily Mae how to handle one of his tools. It was too heavy for her to even pick up. But have you ever heard of such a thing? I said, J.D., she's a little girl. And he said, girls can do whatever they want to do. Which I guess is a good way to look at it. But a nail gun?
But then, Hazel Marie went on,
he does something so sweet that I can't stay mad at him. You know Mrs. Randolph, who lives across the street from us in that little English cottage?
Oh, yes, Ethel Randolph. She lost her husband last year.
Yes, and she's been kind of lost herself since then. Anyway, those people working on the Cochrane house park on both sides of the street, making it so narrow that two cars can't get through at the same time. And yesterday, one of them parked so that the back end extended over Mrs. Randolph's driveway, and she couldn't get her car out. J.D. saw her standing over there crying because she was about to be late for a doctor's appointment, and the owner of the car had gone off with somebody else to buy picture hangers.
Oh, how thoughtless. Lillian, frowning, said, some people don't think of nobody but themselves.
Well, they won't do it again, because J.D. got me to take Mrs. Randolph to her appointment. I had to wait almost 2 hours to bring her home. So thank goodness Granny Wiggins was with the children. Anyway, when I brought her home, that whole side of the street had been cleared out. J.D. had called the police, and they'd had that car towed. And the owner got a citation and a fine when she came back with her picture hangers. And on top of that, I don't know how he did it, but there were signs going up all along that side of the street saying, "No parking this side." And J.D. stood out there and pointed his finger in Mrs. Randolph's face and told her if anybody ever parked there again, she was to call either him or the police or both. And she was so grateful that she cried on his shoulder.
Hazel Marie sighed.
He can be just so sweet.
Uh-huh, I said, willing to be but not entirely convinced.
But,
Hazel Marie went on,
wait till you hear what else he's doing.
Lillian, spellbound by the tales of Mr. Pickens's derring do, asked,
what in the world else?
Well,
Hazel Marie said, as if ridding herself of a great burden,
you know there's room for 3 cars to park on the street in front of our house, one between our driveway and the property line where J.D.'s fence is, and 2 more from the driveway to the corner of the block. Actually, there's room for 3, but there's a fire hydrant at the corner where nobody can park. So those places fill up fast with all the ladies and some men coming and going next door, and it drives J.D. crazy to see them all lined up in front of our house. Anyway, yesterday afternoon, after they'd all left, J.D. told James to move his car from the garage and put it in one of those parking places. And he was about to put his car and mine in the other 2 places until he realized that we'd all be going and coming, which meant that somebody could take our places while we were gone.
Hazel Marie pushed her hair back, then heaved another deep sigh.
So off he went and came back with 3, Miss Julia, old beat-up cars from a used car lot and parked them in the spaces in front of our house. I said, J.D., did you go out and buy those cars? And he said, nope. I made an arrangement with the owner. If you look on the windshield, you'll see signs that say good used cars from Carson and Sons. I'm giving him free off-site advertising space in return for parking them here.
Hazel Marie blew out her breath.
Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Well, no, I haven't, but I certainly admire his creative thinking. I didn't mention the fact that there'd still be cars parked in front of his house, but I guess it makes a difference when you do it yourself. Chapter 25 Hazel Marie wouldn't stay for lunch. She had errands to run, and with her husband on a rampage, she knew better than to stay away from home for too long. But just as Lillian got out the bread and mayonnaise to make sandwiches, Luann called and rescued me from another egg salad sandwich.
I know it's late to be calling, Luann said, but if you haven't eaten, let's go to lunch.
Pleased to get out of the house, I agreed, and we met at the popular Hot Dog Palace, as a change, you know, from tea rooms and fusion restaurants. Not that either of us ordered hot dogs. We both had the bacon, lettuce, and tomato, or BLT, sandwiches. Only they turned out to be bacon, lettuce, and fried green tomato sandwiches, or I guess BLFGT sandwiches, which sounded slightly questionable. Whatever they were good and made a hearty change from salads, dainty sandwiches, and strange sauces. An added plus was that the Hot Dog Palace did not offer wine, either by the glass or by the bottle, so I didn't have to watch and worry as Luann imbibed.
Julia,
Luann said as she unwrapped a knife and fork from a paper napkin,
tell me the truth. Did you know about Leonard and that Totsie woman?
Uh-oh, I thought. Who wanted to get into such a conversation with every plumber, electrician, contractor, and half the secretaries in town eating lunch around us? Lowering my voice and leaning toward her, I said,
No, Luann, I promise you I did not know until you sent me into the courthouse to look for him, and even then I wasn't sure.
Of course I had heard the rumors, but I had not known. So I hoped that my equivocation would satisfy her. I mean, who would rush to a friend and say, guess what your husband's doing? On the other hand, no wife wants to be the last to know.
When and what to tell certainly presents a conundrum to anyone who wants to both help and protect a friend. To tell the truth, every time I thought of how Luann's husband had lived two lives for years, I'd get so angry on her behalf that I could hardly see straight, and I wasn't so dense that I didn't realize I was identifying with her, because the very same thing had happened to me. I was well aware that my anger toward Leonard was partially aimed at Wesley Lloyd Springer, my late, unmissed first husband, and I also knew what a futile exercise that was, seeing that Wesley Lloyd was 6 feet under and had been that way for years. As the young waitress placed our orders before us, we thanked her and began eating. Thank goodness for something to divert Luann from further questions of what I'd known and when I'd known it. Her question, however, had been a reminder of the only thing that continued to trouble me about my first marriage, and that was the question of what I would have done if I'd learned of Wesley Lloyd's double life before, instead of after I'd buried him. I was still not sure if, at that time in my life, I would have had the courage to leave him. To see that Luann, the neediest woman I knew, so obviously had that courage made me not only admire her, but also wonder where it had come from. Hoping, though, to direct her away from airing her problems in such a public place, I asked, "So how are you getting along?" "Better by the day," she said, squeezing a lemon wedge into a glass of tea. "You know, Julia, this is the first time in my life that I've lived alone. I had sisters at home and roommates in college. Then I got married and had my boys. So this is the first time I've ever had constant peace and quiet. And also the first time I've not had to pick up after anybody." Wiping lemon juice from her hands with a napkin, she added, "And that's a blessing." "I can understand that." "No, you can't. You've got Lillian to do your picking up." "Luann," I said in exasperation, "you could have had help if you'd wanted it, and you know it." "Maybe so," she agreed amiably enough. "But like a lot of women, I thought that taking care of a husband was my job."
"So did I. Not just taking care of him, but putting up with him, too. Luann," I went on as if imparting a sudden insight, "I think I know the secret. You either marry the right man, as I've done, but only on my second try, or you get out and live by yourself, as you're doing. Staying married for the sake of being married is ridiculous, and probably bad for your health as well."
"It certainly would have been for Leonard's," she said so seriously that I had to laugh, and after a second so did she.
"So you don't miss him?" I asked, relieved to hear her laugh.
A distressed look swept across her face. Then she said,
"A little. Just now and then, for the company, you know. But then I think of not having to cook a big breakfast the next morning, and I get over it."
"Good for you," I said, rescuing a tomato slice that was sliding out of my sandwich. "And I mean that."
"Well, anyway," she said, "the trick is to stay busy, and that reminds me. Madge Taylor dropped by the other day, and as usual, she wanted me to help her with some kind of fundraiser."
I waited to respond while the waitress refilled our glasses. Then, as casually as I could manage, I asked,
"Fundraiser for what?"
Luann shrugged.
"Who knows? I told her I couldn't, since I'm having to raise funds for my own self these days, but she also wanted to make sure that I'd be coming to a tea she's having to show off a place for the homeless or something."
"I hope you told her that your regrets were already in the mail, because if you didn't, you'll miss something that's never been done before."
Mildred and I are giving back-to-back parties on the same date and at the same time as Madge's, and anybody who goes to hers instead of or in addition to ours will be on our do-not-invite list for about 50 years. Luann's eyes widened.
"You mean that?"
"Trust and see.
I said with a firm nod of my head. Madge Taylor has overstepped for the last time, and all gloves are off from now on.
Well, my goodness, I know she's a busybody, but I always thought she had a good heart.
As I rolled my eyes, Luann went on.
Madge also wanted to know if I'd be interested in being a house mother or a foster mother or some such thing. She said I'd get my own room, complete with a large television set and a small salary. She thought I'd be perfect since, as she said, I no longer have a husband to fill my time.
I dropped the last half of my sandwich onto my plate and leaned back, just so disgusted I could hardly speak. I hope you told her what she could do with that.
Oh, well, you know I was flattered that somebody wanted me. If I didn't already have the perfect place to live, I might have been interested.
Luann, do you not know what it'd be like to take care of 5 or 6 teenage boys, day and night, 7 days a week? And do you not know that she wanted to move you into that house next door to Hazel Marie and that J.D. Pickens is doing everything he can to drive them away because they're breaking the law by being there?
Oh, is that the house? I've been wondering who was doing so much work on it.
I mopped my brow with my napkin, wondering where in the world she'd been for the past few weeks. Well, I knew, for Luann had had her own problems. No one leaves a husband one has had for 40 years without having one's mind filled with ifs, ands, and buts, and very little else. And to confirm what I'd just been thinking, Luann said,
"Leonard called me the other night."
"Really? What did he want? He's missing you, isn't he?"
"I don't know if he's missing me or my cooking."
Luann squinched up her face at the memory of the phone call. Then she said,
"He wanted my recipe for squash casserole so Tootsie could make it for him."
"Why, the nerve of him! What did you say?"
"Nothing. I hung up."
"Good for you, Luann. I declare that beats all I've ever heard. You are doing so well now that you're on your own, and I hope you won't let yourself get dragged back into the mess he's made."
"I know, and I don't intend to go through all that emotional turmoil again."
Luann stopped, looked around the restaurant, then said,
"Do you really think I'm doing well?"
"I certainly do. You look better than you have in years. You have more confidence because you know you can do this, and everybody admires you for refusing to put up with Leonard's idea of a mixed marriage. You're doing fine, Luann. But I'll tell you who isn't." She leaned forward.
"Who?"
"Helen Stroud. Mildred is concerned about her, and I guess I am, too. She's so taken up with that house of Thurlow's and spending so much of his money that it seems she's lost any sense of moderation. Everybody's always assumed that Thurlow is wealthy, but who really knows? He thinks she's spending him into the poorhouse, and it is a fact that even the very wealthy can reach the end of the road eventually." Luann frowned.
"Yes, but how would anybody know? He's such a tightwad, he might just resent spending any of it. You would think, though, that Helen knows how much he has and how freely she can spend. Didn't you say that they have a contract or something?"
"That's what she told me. And Helen is good with money. She's had experience with having plenty and having hardly any, so it's hard to believe that she'd be extravagant enough to pauperize him. Because if I understood her correctly, spending it all would do the same thing to her."
"Well, my goodness," Luann said, reaching for another napkin. "Is there any way we could find out? I mean, if Thurlow just thinks she's overspending, we could at least reassure him. If he would listen to us."
"Well, don't say anything about this, because I don't know if it's a good idea or not. But Mildred is worried that Helen might be, well, I guess, addicted to that house. She's thinking we ought to stage an intervention and get her back on track." Luann's eyes lit up with interest.
"Really? How would an intervention work?"
"I looked it up. And what you do is have the subject, that would be Helen,
come to a meeting of family and friends without knowing their plan. Then, everybody takes turns telling the subject what she or he is doing wrong and warns of the consequences of continuing to do it. Then, according to what I read, they're supposed to immediately take the subject to rehab.
Rehab? I've never heard of a rehab place for spending too much.
I know, I said tiredly, and that's certainly a problem. But I thought I'd run the idea past you, because of all of us, you've known Thurlow the longest.
Yes, I guess I have. We were in school together, although he was a couple of grades ahead of me. But, Julia, as long as I've known him, he's always had money. I mean, that was the assumption, that his family was loaded. And he was the only child, so he inherited everything, including that house he grew up in. It was just his cantankerous character that made him live like a street bum. I think he enjoyed the contrast, knowing he had a lot but acting like he didn't.
Where did the family money come from?
I don't know. They just always seemed to have it. And Julia, they were highly thought of around town. His father was a state senator for several terms, and I can remember my mother thinking the world of his mother. She was a real lady, and every year she'd entertain the Abbotsville girls who'd been invited to make their debut at the Rhododendron Ball.
Luann's eyes glowed with the memory.
I'll never forget my year, and that lovely supper dance she gave for us.
She blew out her breath and went on.
It's hard to believe that Thurlow came from such stock, knowing what he's like now.
Well, no longer now, because Helen has taken over. Even though she's gotten rid of Thurlow's dog, she's making sure he's taking his medicine, eating right, and has clean sheets on his bed. Thurlow's bed, I mean, not the dog's. Chapter 26. After I'd cautioned Luann against repeating anything I'd said about intervening in Helen's control and distribution of Thurlow's funds, I still went home worried that I'd said too much to the most talkative woman in town. I knew better than to tell Luann anything that wasn't for general broadcasting, yet I'd let my concern get the better of me and had said too much. Trying to rectify my lapse, I'd warned Luann that if she passed it along, I would not only never tell her anything else ever again, I'd stop speaking to her entirely. But who knew whom or what she'd tell? The thing to do, I concluded, was to urge Mildred to proceed with the intervention fairly soon, if she was convinced that it had to be done. In other words, we should get it done before Luann could hold it in no longer. But first things first. So I hurried home to call Mildred and tell her we'd better get on the phone right away. Mildred, I said when she answered, we've overlooked something. Madge's tacky tea invitations have gone out, so we ought to call around and tell everybody that something better is in the offing and do it before they RSVP Madge with an acceptance.
You think? I don't care if they accept her invitation just as long as they don't show up for it and come to ours instead.
Oh, well, I don't know how many will do that. I mean, there are people who'll feel obligated to go to Madge's tea if they've said they will. They may not want to, but they'll think they ought to.
You're probably right, Mildred agreed. We should divide the list and make a few calls, I guess. We can tell each one to let somebody else know, and pretty soon the word'll get around.
You don't sound very concerned, so maybe I'm overly so. I just know that some will feel obligated to honor an acceptance.
Oh, Mildred said with no concern at all. They'll change their minds. Just wait, Julia, because I'm already having my house decorated for the party, and for Christmas, of course, and a reporter and a photographer will be here in a couple of days from that beautiful new regional magazine, Scenic. You've seen it, haven't you?
Well, anyway, they're featuring my house in the next issue, which will be out a week before our parties. I plan to play out both of our parties in the interview, and everybody will be eager to come, whether or not they've accepted Madge's invitation. I had to laugh.
I should know better than to ever underestimate you, Mildred. You're always two steps ahead of me.
But listen, are you sure they'll have your house in the upcoming issue before our parties? I thought those features were planned months in advance.
They probably are, Mildred agreed with an air of compassion.